Today on Pilot's Discretion, our guest is airline pilot, airshow pilot, and flight instructor Tim Decker. He talks about the difference between minimum fuel and emergency fuel, lessons from the Cirrus Vision Jet, and flying the F-117 Nighthawk. Pilot's Discretion starts right now. Welcome, pilots. I'm John Zimmerman of Sporties, and thanks for listening to Pilot's Discretion. If you like the show, please follow us in your favorite podcast app, and remember, you can catch up on every previous episode by visiting sporties.com/podcast. Today, our guest is Tim Decker, who has a diverse aviation background. He flew the T-38, U-2, and F-117 in the Air Force, then had a successful career as an airshow pilot flying a Pitts, before working as a corporate pilot flying the Phenom 300. He's currently a 767 captain at FedEx and also an experienced Cirrus pilot instructing in the SF-50 Vision Jet, and he owns an SR-22. Tim, welcome to Pilot's Discretion.
Good day. How you doing, John?
Thanks for being with us. The original reason we got connected was an article you wrote for the Cirrus Owners and Pilots Association magazine, and the topic was minimum fuel versus emergency fuel, which I thought was a interesting concept that most GA pilots don't really talk about. So what's the difference between those two phrases?
Well, I think most pilots understand that minimum fuel is a state that's not quite an emergency. It just means that I can't accept any undue delays. And emergency fuel is just what it infers there, an emergency. The problem I saw after reading some accident reports is, how does a typical GA pilot use those in his or her flying? And I realized in the airlines, in a Part 121 operation, our dispatchers tell us specifically on each flight, depending on how much we weigh, exactly what our minimum emergency fuel is. And I thought, well, why do we have people running out of gas and then declaring an emergency after they've run out of gas in the weather, and getting themselves into fatal type trouble? Why didn't they declare minimum fuel? Why didn't they declare emergency fuel? And I was talking to a friend that I taught to fly, as a matter of fact, and he said, well, nobody really tells us when and how to do those. And so I took what off a flight release I had, and I noticed that our minimum fuel is declared when we're down. We're IFR, of course, flying Part 121. Our minimum fuel is, we are told per the book to declare minimum fuel IFR when you're down to 45 minutes of fuel. And then the dispatchers tell you exactly how many pounds of fuel that is based on that aircraft's weight that day. And then in addition to that, they tell us to declare emergency fuel when you're down to 30 minutes. And so it's very cut and dry. And then I thought, well, why did somebody with a average GA airplane could just go out and fly, maybe a short cross country somewhere, do a couple approaches, and see how much gas they use, and then divide that out, see how many gallons, usually they're in gallons, how many gallons they're using per hour. So just for simple math, let's just say you figured out you're flying like a turbocharged Bonanza or a Cirrus or something like that. And you figured out that with mixture full rich and doing your approaches and so forth, you, for round numbers, let's say you're 20 gallons an hour. So that'd be pretty simple. 15 gallons, you'd be minimum fuel. And then at 10 gallons, you'd be emergency fuel. And a lot of the modern avionics tell us how much fuel we have remaining when we get over the destination, fuel over destination. We have to realize that's at the current ground speed and the current winds aloft and the current fuel flow setting. That's why I think it would be important, if you're going to try to do this in your own personal airplane, to just get a rough number, be conservative with it, and set those numbers up in your head and have them written down or memorized or something, so you, before you take off, you know exactly when you might have to declare minimum or emergency fuel. And that's why I wrote that article. It's just a shame to see, I quoted a fatal accident up in the Northeast that AOPA did a very good accident analysis on. It's just sad to see something like that happen. And it's probably our fault as general aviation instructors to not teach that better is what I might say.
It's a great point about going and flying it. I think a lot of people know, oh, you know, 30 minutes or 45 minutes per the FARs. A lot of people, myself included, like to use 1 hour as kind of our minimum fuel in the tanks. But 1 hour at what rate? And as you step up into more high-performance airplanes, that can really vary. Whereas maybe a 172, you're going to burn, whatever, 9 gallons an hour pretty much on most trips. As you mentioned, you get into higher-performance turbocharged airplane. I know in an SR-22 I fly, you can burn 13 gallons an hour up high in cruise, but down low, if you're full rich doing a go-around, you can easily burn over 20 gallons an hour and can make a big difference. So I think that's a huge part of it. I wonder why, you know, it's human nature to avoid declaring an emergency. And lots of pilots have shared stories about this where they knew they were in trouble, but they couldn't bring themselves to say the E word. And I get the sense that actually airline pilots are maybe better at this, if not perfect, because you hear stories somewhat frequently where they have an issue, they declare an emergency. This happened recently in Canada with the FedEx MD-11, had a thrust reverser deploy. Not a great situation, but they declared an emergency. They handled it. They ran the checklist. ATC cooperated brilliantly, I thought, and they landed safely.
Right.
What are some things we can do, some strategies to make it more automatic or less frightening to use that E word, especially when it comes to fuel? I mean, when the facts are staring you in the face, what works in the airline world?
That's a great question. And again, it comes down to training. As you mentioned, I spent 20 years in the military and I was a military flight instructor, and we spent a lot of time in the simulator. That unfortunately, general aviation pilots don't get that luxury, a lot of time in the sim. And in the simulator, it's easy to throw emergencies at the person being trained. And we're trained from day one, just declare an emergency, maintain aircraft control, analyze the situation, take appropriate action, land as soon as conditions permit. It's just comes out that easily. And as a prior Air Force pilot, I taught that, I live by that. And so it's not that big a deal to declare an emergency. So it comes down to training, and I would encourage our flight instructors to train this, at least through scenario-based training. You don't have to have a multi-million dollar simulator, but a lot of times in flight training, we're just moving an airplane between two airports to go practice something at the other airport, maybe an instrument approach or maybe some soft or short field takeoffs where it's airport that's not as busy as our home airport or something like that. So maybe en route, you know, why not just say, this, John, this is simulated. Engine failure. Just walk through that. And if there happens to be another suitable place to land underneath us, you know, take it to a logical conclusion. If you can, land, you know, engine out at an unplanned field that the instructor sees underneath you, you know, instead of always going towards some crazy little short field and doing a go around kind of thing, you know, take scenario based training, make it more realistic. I'll oftentimes just say, this is simulated. You see an enunciator that says low oil pressure. What are you going to do? And what I noticed over the years, a lot of GA pilots just rip stuff out of memory, just start moving levers around and telling me stuff. And as an airline pilot or as a military pilot, it always kind of just, you know, surprises me a little bit, especially in some of these newer airplanes that have all the checklists electronically right in front of you. So if it's not a critical memory item, I would expect somebody to open up the checklist. The one I always give is unexpected loss of manifold pressure for a turbocharged airplane, because there's different causes of that. That's a perfect one to open up a checklist for, you know, and just work your way through it. And so that's what I would encourage instructors to give scenario-based training, even in the airplane, since we don't have that luxury of these multi-million dollar simulators. And then during the debrief, if the student didn't simulate declaring an emergency with ATC. And if I'm the instructor, I just say, I'll be your ATC right now for just VFR out there. I'll just give me all your radio calls. I'll be ATC's as well. So have the instructors give scenario-based training. That would probably be my recommendation, and have the instructors remind the student to declare an emergency. And you asked another thing, when do we declare an emergency in GA? And I fly personally as well. I'm very fortunate to have a SR-22 Cirrus. And I think to myself, do I want crash, fire, and rescue in place at my intended spot of landing or short of there if I don't make it? Do I want them in place or not? So if it's anything that could result in possibly departing the runway or a fire or anything like that, I wouldn't hesitate at all to declare an emergency. And the worst case is you get on the ground and everything's fine and taxi to the FBO. I had one recently at FedEx where the flaps didn't come down at all on a mountain type airport, a high elevation, high density altitude airport at night. and the flaps didn't come down. And if we don't do this perfectly with these higher approach speeds and high density altitude and everything, maybe a thrust reverser doesn't come out, I could, sail off the end of the runway, and I definitely want them there right away instead of wait until the airplane's off the end of the runway and then calling them. They have to put all their gear on and respond. So all the checklists, all the performance data supported landing there, no flap, and we did successfully, no problems at all. But nonetheless, we still declared the emergency, as you pointed out, and it was great because we came to a stop and the fire crew, they shot the brakes with an IR gun, infrared gun, to see the temperatures and declare and determine that they were not excessive, which allowed us to taxi into the gate safely so that we didn't endanger anybody else with hot brakes and so forth. So that's kind of my thought process on declaring an emergency. If you can't quite figure out, is this an emergency or not, ask yourself that second question. Would it be better for myself and my passengers to have crash, fire, and rescue in place as I land? If it's something so minor that you really don't need them there, you've lost an alternator and your second alternator is working just fine. It's good weather and everything. No reason to declare an emergency there if the backup's working, you know what I mean? But I would just ask myself, do I want crash, fire, rescue in place? It would be a good secondary question.
Yeah, I think some pilots think that somehow air traffic control is going to be upset or mad at you in that case. And if you listen to examples, you can find dozens of these on YouTube. Generally, when a pilot declares an emergency, you hear the controller get very calm and very direct and sometimes move you to a separate frequency where you're the only airplane on the frequency. And they can't fly the airplane for you. That's on you. But you get a lot of help and a lot of service. That my advice generally is, if you think you should declare an emergency, you probably should. If it's even a consideration, it's better to start it.
I think, well, I'm not an ATC controller, of course. I think it makes it easier on both parties if you just declare the emergency. I've actually seen ATC declare an emergency for an airplane just so they can have those dedicated resources. And it just clears it up. So sometimes lack of not doing it is more confusing. It's the pilot that says, no, I don't want to declare an emergency, but I need this, I need this, I need that, that puts the ATC in an awkward spot. I think they just assume have us declare the emergency so that they can give us the dedicated resources. They know what to do with the other airplanes around. Do they need to hold them? Do they need to put them on a different runway? It just makes it a lot clearer for everybody.
Another thing the airlines do slightly differently than most GA pilots is detailed procedures for planning and performance. You've talked before about concept of factored landing distance, which is something probably most GA pilots have not even heard of. So what is that, and what is the general concept of how in the 121 world you approach runway performance?
It's very clear with Part 121 operations where the takeoff and landing data is very clear depending on a dry runway, a wet runway, different types of contaminations. They have 1/8 inch compacted snow and all kinds of stuff up to thicker snow and so forth. So it's very, very clear. But then when you get into the GA world, you find it's because the planes are not certified to the same level standards that they're not required to have such detailed takeoff and landing data. So it's, ours is in the airline world, it's very clear. We run the numbers based on the current ATIS, the current conditions, and then we just salute smartly and we land if the numbers support it, take off if the numbers support it, and we don't land, we hold or we divert if the numbers are out. And then you mentioned corporate air aviation. Corporate jets in the GA world, have a not so great reputation of going off the end of the runway during landing. It's probably the number one, I think that's the number one accident in corporate aviation. And I was having a discussion recently with a manufacturer. I won't say the name, but one of my clients is thinking about buying their corporate jet. He's currently flies a Cirrus Vision jet, and he's thinking about moving up into a light twin. And this airplane's had a history of going off the end of the runway. And I asked the demo pilot that we were with to see the POH and see the data. And I said, can I see the wet runway data? And I was told there is no wet runway data. We just take the dry data and multiply by 1.3, and that's our wet number. So, you know, if the landing distance is 3,000 feet dry, this manufacturer just says multiply by 1.3, and now your wet distance would be, what, 3,900 feet. And I said, is there any factor in that? And they said, all our landing distances in this POH, we already take the test pilot data, and the numbers we give the consumer are times 1.3 already. So the dry was already times the test pilot data, 1.3, and then another 1.3 for the for the wet. My point is that it's a very inexact science on the GA side of the house compared to the airline side of the house. When I flew corporate for a very big corporate department based out of Columbus, Ohio, you might know who they are. The Phenom 300 that I flew was having the same type of problem with wet runways, and our corporation gave us a factor. If the runway was wet and ungrooved, so there's grooved runways and there's ungrooved runways. The grooved runways you'll find at concrete type runways at the bigger airports. Smaller airports are typically asphalt type runways that are not grooved. There's a huge difference between the rain and a wet on each of those runways, and because of the history of the Phenom 300 and doing this, our company said, okay, if it's not grooved, here's a factor to multiply by. So that's just a general overview of the whole subject. Now, if you use ForeFlight and you use their takeoff and landing data, you can tap factored versus unfactored. And that's and the factor there is 1.67. So if you're on ForeFlight and you pay the little bit extra for the version that gives you data like that, you can take the unfactored, multiply that by 1.67, tap it to factor, and you'll get the same number that they're doing. So that's if you were flying Part 135 or flying for hire, you would be obligated to use the factor, the 1.67. That's something else that I don't think we do a good job teaching the average general aviation pilot. We just tell them about the numbers in the back of the POH, and most good instructors will remind them that it's a brand new airplane with a test pilot doing everything perfectly at sea level on a standard day, but they don't really tell you a whole lot more than that. It's other than, you know, kind of use it with a grain of salt. I would recommend that if you're just using that number in the back of your POH, at a minimum, if we're flying your family for hire, multiply it by 1.67. If you're flying yourself, or you're flying your family for yourself, do the same thing. Use factored distances would be a good starting point, and keep a lot of people out of trouble, especially these corporate jets that are landing long and hot and going off the end of the runway.
Yeah, that's a big, if you look into the loss of control accidents, which is a broad term, a lot of those loss of control isn't necessarily your classic stall spin on base to final, although there's some of those. A lot of them are that runway loss of control, and it's either they haven't run the math, or a reminder that that math only works if you're flying the appropriate approach speed. And so if VREF is 85 knots and you're flying 95 knots, all of those numbers you calculated are right out the window. So the pilot technique matters quite a bit.
It does, and it goes back to that high school physics with kinetic energy and so forth. And what was it? One half MV squared. And so V being velocity. So that extra 10 knots squaring that number, it's a big, big difference with the kinetic energy. So that pulls us back into that conversation of stable approaches. And stable approaches, again, in the airline world is king. It's just very, very, important. I've had people criticize. They say, "Well, we don't do in GA. We don't do ILSs to big long runways all the time, so it doesn't apply to us." I would argue that, well, one, I don't do ILSs all the time. I do some crazy approaches down in South America that you don't have the you don't have that luxury of a big, long, straight-in approach, what we call RNP approaches, these curving approaches that have very short finals because of the surrounding high terrain. And so we don't necessarily do ILSs all the time to big, long runways either. But nonetheless, we are stable by 500 feet if it's visual, stable by 1,000 AGL if you're in the instruments. And when I fly my family around in my personal airplane, I use those same minimums just to give myself that safety factor.
Tim, let's take a quick break. And when we come back, I'd like to ask you about the Cirrus world a little bit more.
Earn all your pilot ratings and keep your flying skills sharp with Sporty's Pilot Training Plus. This all-inclusive membership unlocks Sporty's complete library of award-winning video courses, so you can learn anywhere you have your phone, tablet, or laptop. For one annual fee, you get access to over $1,500 in courses, a smart investment in your flying career. Plus, enjoy free shipping every day of the year at sporties.com and apply for one of our three annual flight training scholarships. Learn more at sporties.com/pilot training. Now, back to Pilot's Discretion.
We are back with Tim Decker, who is a well-known instructor in the Cirrus world, both in the Piston SR series, which he flies, and the Turbin SF series, which he instructs in. Tim, the Cirrus safety record has improved a lot over the years, from pretty terrible, honestly, early in the airplane's existence to what I would call industry-leading over the last 5 or 6 years. Certainly always room for improvement, but there's been a real significant change. What do you think we should learn from that? What's the lesson? What changed in the Cirrus community that turned the tide?
I would say training. Training is the company itself, Cirrus Aircraft, puts a lot of time and effort into their training programs, just a world-class videos and online support to take courses. So the training, they standardize their instructors. They're called CSIPs, Cirrus Standardized Instructor Pilots. While any single engine instructor is legal per the FAA to instruct, and most insurance companies will require that somebody buying an airplane be instructed by a Cirrus trained instructor. So that's the standardization there. And then outside of Cirrus Aircraft, the owners group called COPA, Cirrus Owners and Pilots Association, they've done a wonderful job with continuation training and seminars and gatherings where they give briefings and everyone socializes, and then you can go out with a CSIP as part of the long weekend of seminars and so forth and fly in your own airplane and get some one-on-one time. So they've done a wonderful job with that as well. Other aircraft manufacturers, Bonanza's done similar things with BPPP. But I would say Cirrus Aircraft with their online training is just wonderful.
Obviously, avionics, a big part of the Cirrus. That's become a big part of most airplanes now, but they were early on with the integrated glass cockpit. I would assume as an instructor, that's something that gets a lot of attention. And there's a balance between learning to master those avionics so you can really be proficient with them and get the maximum value, but not be dependent upon them. So what is your tip as an instructor there for finding that right balance? Are there habits or exercises we should do as pilots?
Yeah, I've been studying this and thinking about it for years since it first started. I was lucky enough in the Air Force to fly some of the first purely glass aircraft, the F-117, and then the U-2, believe it or not, was retrofitted with a complete glass panel in the mid or late 1990s, 2000s. When I retired, quickly got introduced to Cirrus, this was back around 2009. And like you said, we did Avidyne cockpits and then quickly became a pure Garmin cockpits. And as an instructor, I thought, I'd learned on all analog stuff before IFR approved GPSs, and then quickly transition to glass and learn that well. So as an instructor, I'm kind of a 50-50 type person. If I teach somebody to fly a Cirrus from day one, I introduce all the functionality of the glass. I make them set the heading bug before their first takeoff on their first flight lesson. I have them set the first altitude we plan on leveling off at, even on that first flight, just to have it be part of the habit pattern. And their transition later on to instruments is quite simple because we've already have a good baseline with that. And instrument flying, I would expect about half the approaches we fly while we're training to be hand flown, and about half use them fully coupled up with the autopilot. And I even teach just flight director only. So there's like three different ways to fly a modern glass GA cockpit there. And I make sure that we can differentiate between those three ways of doing it. And you're comfortable doing any of them, because if everything's working well and the weather's poor, I would expect us to use the automation and use autopilot for safety. Why take off and get the gear up and the flaps up or whatever airplane you're in and be hand flying while you're messing with radios and navigation? Why do that? Why not just switch on the autopilot, aviate, navigate, communicate, and in that order, and make it as simple as possible for the simplicity for yourself and comfort and safety of your passengers. So I expect the pilots I fly with to be very comfortable using the full automation, the autopilot, but I also expect them to, if that's not going the way they want it, just to click it all off, understand the raw data, and just fly on the raw data, no flight director, no autopilot.
I know you also do a fair amount of instruction in the Vision Jet, which I would guess is the first turbine airplane for many owners of that airplane. What do you find is the most difficult part of that transition? Is it the performance, the systems, the avionics? What surprises people when they jump into their first jet?
You know, the Vision Jet's kind of a funny airplane because it has the performance more of a great turboprop. It doesn't really have the true performance of like a Phenom 100 or a Citation Jet. It has more of a TBM type performance. So it's not terribly fast. The final approach speed's not a whole lot different than an SR-22 turbo, maybe 10 knots faster. The speed, I don't think, is a problem. It's just managing the avionics. The avionics are very, very similar. If they transition out of a modern SR-22 with a Garmin perspective, the avionics are very, very close to that. You know, bringing up an approach, an arrival procedure, or standard instrument departure, those are all the same buttonology pretty much. But with the G3000, it's just different enough that it can it could be a little bit confusing. But I think they've done such a good job of making it similar to the SR series that it's not as big of a transition as it would be, say, going from a Bonanza or a Cirrus into a CJ or a Phenom 100.
All right, Tim, at the end of every episode, we always close with a lightning round called Ready to Copy. I'll ask some questions on a variety of topics, and you give me your quick answer. You ready to copy?
Ready to copy.
You flew the F-117 Nighthawk in the Air Force, as you mentioned, which is absolutely a fascinating airplane, I think, for many people. I know for me, it was the first airplane I saw at an air show and just said, wow, how does that fly?
Yeah.
What's the most interesting fact about that airplane that at least you're allowed to share?
How it's kept secret for so long. The plane is made up of different parts and pieces of the different fighters at the time. So the fly-by-wire avionics came out of the F-16. The engines came out of the F-18. The landing gear, I think, was F-15. So they were able to take parts and pieces from different airplanes and if you took it all the parts and pieces underneath the skin out of one airplane, say the F-15, people would notice that, but budget type folks and accounting and so forth. But since they kind of did it out of different airframes, that helped them keep it secret for so long. And so underneath the radar absorbent material that you see, it was basically made up of other modern fighters that were flying at the time.
That's fascinating. You also flew the U-2, which is another iconic airplane, which has always looked like a great challenge in a landing. So how would you describe landing the U-2 in a crosswind with a long wingspan?
The U-2 is designed to be flown high. It does a very, very nice job of flying above 60,000 feet. It's optimized for that. That's where the autopilot is used, and the clutches are all perfect for up high, and the sensors that you have during the mission. You basically cannot use the autopilot down low, and I think, you know, we were defining low as below about 45,000 feet. The autopilot wasn't very effective, and it's almost a little bit dangerous because the clutches were just not designed for that. So it would do strange things on you. It wouldn't hold what you intended to have it do. So we typically just hand flew every single takeoff, all the climb, and engaged it probably in the low 50s, and then on the way back down, disengaged it in the low 50s and hand flew from there. You asked about a crosswind. That's one bad thing about it. It has one main gear and a tailwheel. So it's just like any tailwheel airplane. You said you'd fly a Citabria, so you you understand the center of gravity is behind the main gear there. So if you don't land it straight, it will ground loop just like any tail dragger will. And we would fly very long missions. We would plan 9 or 10 hour missions in a spacesuit and with an hour of pre-breathing oxygen beforehand. So when you come back, say at night over in the desert or in Korea during a snowstorm after flying for 9 or 10 hours, it can be very fatiguing. So to help mitigate some of that risk, we would land it with a chase car. So the backup pilot would be driving the chase car with a full set of U-2 checklists. And that pilot is prepared to fly that mission that day. If you wake up and you're not feeling well, you would just switch duties with that backup pilot. Anyway, during landing, especially with the crosswind, it's very nice to have that chase car behind you, giving you call outs, especially if you're a little fatigued and in the space helmet, you don't have the best visibility and you have a big long nose in front blocking some visibility as well. So the chase car can tell you how high you are above the runway and whether you need a little left rudder or right rudder. They can even give you calls like hold it off if they see you descending too quickly, because you don't want to bounce the aircraft if you're descending too quickly. So they'll give you calls like that so you can get a consistent, safe landing.
Sounds like a great idea. I could have used that when I got my tailwheel.
Yeah, that'd be nice. But you know, the neat thing was we would practice landings without those radio calls. So we would just on a training flight, we would just make a radio call, a no voice landing, just say a no voice, and we wouldn't expect the chase car to say anything unless there was a safety of flight problem. That way, you could practice your skills on your own. So that if you had to divert somewhere in the real world, you could land with confidence without that assistance.
You got to fly the T-38 in addition to the F-117 and the U-2. Which one of those is the most fun to fly?
You know, I always say that's kind of like asking somebody that has both a, you know, a Harley road bike and a dirt bike on a beautiful Sunday afternoon, good weather. Which motorcycle is more fun? And the motorcyclist would be like, what are you talking about? They're completely different. So I would probably answer it the same way. They're all different. And I just try to love the one I'm with, you know, and whatever airplane I'm in at the time, I try to enjoy and its capabilities and its mission and enjoy flying that one at the time.
You've flown a lot of aerobatics, including as an air show performer. What's the most important lesson you learn when you fly aerobatics?
Well, the two lessons would be, again, training and maintenance. I tried never to skimp on anything. I would make sure that my airplane was maintained to the best standards, never take any shortcuts with maintenance. And training, bringing in the discipline there, it could be anything from just strapping into the airplane and making sure your seatbelts are tight and there's no loose items around the cockpit that could fly out and break the canopy or get lodged into the flight controls or whatever. Just so the discipline that comes with the flight training, and then the going out and practicing the routine, practicing it up high at safe altitudes over and over and over again, knowing exactly how much altitude it takes to do a loop at sea level versus 5,000 feet versus 10,000 feet. So that if you had a show in the Denver area, is quite a bit different than flying a show at sea level. So you had to account for altitudes like that. And then the weather as well. So sometimes the weather wouldn't be very good at a show, and the FAA, the inspectors would wave it down to even lower minimums than is normally allowed. So you could actually be doing aerobatics with 1,000-foot ceiling, which is kind of very, very low to be doing aerobatics with the clouds right at 1,000. So knowing exactly the numbers and having very, very good discipline. And if you don't hit the numbers, just abort the maneuver, roll out of it. You're making a lot of smoke, a lot of noise. Most of the crowd probably won't even notice that you're applying on one maneuver and didn't get the right numbers for it. So you knock that one off and went into another one. And most people would never notice. And you're alive the next day.
There's a whole new generation of pilots entering the aviation industry right now. Many of them focused on the airlines, lots of press about that, but you have experience both as a fractional pilot and a cargo pilot. So what are some quick pros and cons of those two options besides the often talked about 121 airline route?
Yeah, the cargo, we're flying that part 121. So the same set of rules, maybe slightly different crew rest rules, but same set of rules. And if, and those are pretty sought after jobs, though, the FedEx, UPS, as well as the major U.S. airlines, Delta, American, United, and Southwest. Almost all those have excellent contracts, union representation, and an overall great future if you're willing to be away and living in hotel rooms for a part of the month. The great thing about those jobs is when you're home, you're actually home. There's really nothing that you bring home with you. So in a typical month, I'll spend about 12 days, 12 nights away from the house and the family and so forth. But the rest of the time that I'm home, it's my time. So that's probably the best thing about that. Corporate jobs are all over the place. If you fly for a big company, like we were talking about, like I did out of Columbus, that was union represented as well and pretty steady, but we worked pretty hard there. We would fly 3 to 5 times a day and be pretty worn out at the end of each day. And I was on a 7-day schedule. I would start on Tuesday mornings and get home on Monday night. And so it was pretty fatiguing, but it was mostly day type fly. Most of the people that can afford corporate aviation aren't flying in the middle of the night. In the cargo world, we fly a lot of nighttime stuff. Probably 60 to 70% of our flying is at night. There's advantages to that. It's less crowded. It's a little easier to get in and out of the busy places like JFK and O'Hare and Miami and so forth. There's pros and cons of each of them, and got to figure out which ones are right for you and go from there. It's hard to tell you. I enjoyed them both. I'll tell you that much.
We've talked a lot about adapting habits from the airline world to GA flying today. I'm wondering if there's anything that goes the other way. Is there something you do as a Cirrus pilot that helps you when you're flying in the 121 world?
I would say the stick and rudder skills, especially the tail whale skills of flying both the Pitt Special and the U2, I think really helps out, because I've never, ever even thought about crossland landings in an airliner. And in the sim, they make us do 30-knot crosswind landings, demonstrate those, which is the limit of the 757 and 767. So we routinely will do 30 knots of crosswind there. And I've never even thought about it. It's just second nature to me. So it's always fun when I can sometimes tell when I'm flying with another pilot that has a lot of GA, especially tail whale time, just the smoothness, the rudder control and so forth. So it does, you can bring some of that into the big airplanes as well.
Our last question is always the same on this podcast. You have one final flight and we want to know, what are you flying and where are you going?
Well, like I say, I spend a lot of time away from the home. I would say I want to be in my own airplane with my family, landing at my own airport, probably at sunset, just a beautiful sunset. It's on my terms. Everything's good to go, and put the airplane away and call it good.
Tim, thanks for being on the podcast.
All right. Thank you, John. Appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to Pilot's Discretion, brought to you by Sporties, training and equipping pilots worldwide for over 60 years. For more episodes and today's show links, visit sporties.com/podcast. I'm John Zimmerman. We'll see you next time on Pilot's Discretion.